There's no denying that exercise brings emotional benefits. Not only does it build your physical strength, but it also boosts your mood, reduces stress, and increases self-esteem. That's why Gymondo is perfect. It's an online fitness and well-being program, with hundreds of 20 to 30 minute workouts, and thousands of recipes. Start a 14-day free trial and save 50% on your annual membership by visiting gymondo.com. That is gymondo.com, and enter the promo code Morbidology.
After I saw everybody die, after I saw my wife die and saw my kids, most definitely, I wanted to be with them. That's the only thing I wanted to be.
Celebration is a 10.7 square mile master plan community located in Florida. It was designed by Disney in the 1990s, so it's probably not much of a surprise that it's just a stone's throw away from the theme parks. The community is extremely charming. It was inspired by Walt Disney's dream of creating a perfect utopian city, and it looks just like small-town America of the mid-20th century. In January of 2020, however, residents of Celebration awoke to the grisly news that a mass murder had taken place in their picturesque community. A mass murder that would show that oftentimes, outward appearances can be deceiving. It was around 9 a.m. on the 13th of January 2020 when the Osceola County Sheriff's Department was called to the home at 202 Reserve Place in the North Village area of Celebration in Florida. They were there to conduct a welfare check on the Tote family. The Tote family consisted of Anthony and Megan and their three children, 13-year-old Alec, 11-year-old Tyler, and 4-year-old Zoe. They also had a dog named Breezy. The Tote family were originally from Colchester in Connecticut, but they had moved over to Celebration in Florida. The Tote family had not been heard from since towards the end of December. Friends and family had received messages from Anthony, who said that they were all suffering from the flu. And then later, Megan's aunt received a text message from him saying that they were going on vacation and not to worry if they couldn't be reached. Since then, however, nobody had heard anything from the family, and concerns for their welfare was mounting. Their loved ones had tried to call them, but received no reply, and all text messages were being sent but not delivered. Anthony's sister, Chrissy, contacted police on the 29th of December and asked them to conduct a welfare check.
I'm wondering if somebody can do a wellness check on my brother and his family. They've been really sick for probably like the past week and a half, and I can't seem to get a hold of them.
Give me just a moment. And the, let me see, I think she said 202 Reserve Place, that's her address?
202 Reserve Place in Celebration.
Okay.
I'm calling from Connecticut, so I'm not sure there's no way for me to easily check. He doesn't have any of his family down there.
Give me one moment, please. All right. When was the last time you heard from them, ma'am?
The last time I physically talked to him was on... either Monday or Tuesday, and he was texting my sisters and I up until Thursday. Was supposed to call us between yesterday and today, and we haven't been able to get a hold of him. I can't get a hold of him, my sister-in-law, or even my nephew.
Okay, what is your name?
My name is Chrissy.
Officers went to the family's home, but when they knocked on the front door, nobody answered. Nothing appeared to be suspicious outside the home, so the deputy simply left. The Totes' loved ones would take to social media, setting up a Facebook page called Looking for the Tote Family, which quickly swelled to over 2,500 members. The Facebook group's description read, "We are looking for the last time anyone has heard from Tony, Megan, and the kids. Please let us know if you have." As the Facebook page grew, local people joined and they offered to go to a reserved place to check in on the family. They were informed that this wasn't necessary, that they had been in contact with police and the police had already been there, but the family weren't there. As concern for the family grew even further, deputies were asked once more to go and check on the family. They returned to the home in celebration again, this time on the 9th of January.
The blinds were all closed. There was no cars parked in front. I knocked and rang the doorbell several times. No one answered.
Much like earlier, nobody opened the door, and as the sheriff said, we didn't notice anything suspicious. So once again, they just left. The Totes' neighbours informed police that they hadn't seen the family since December. The family had attended a Christmas Eve holiday concert at the Windsor at Celebration Senior Living Facility, where the boys were performing. According to those who chatted with the family at the concert, everything appeared to be normal. Since then, however, the family hadn't been seen. Quite often, the family could be seen walking breezy throughout the neighbourhood, but since Christmas Eve, their presence was noticeably absent from the community. Breezy was quite a vocal dog, often barking when somebody passed the window. But even Breezy could not be heard inside the home. While most hadn't heard from the family since December, a neighbour reported that they had texted Megan on the 6th of January, informing her that there was a card on her door. She received a reply, which read, "Okay, thanks." Later that same day, Anthony's mobile phone was found abandoned in a Starbucks in Sarasota. Finally, on the 13th of January, deputies responded to the family's home in celebration. As they pulled up, they saw Anthony outside. He was walking into the home. Deputies approached the home and they knocked on the front door. When nobody answered, they opened up the door and walked in. As soon as they opened the front door, an overwhelming stench hit them in the face. The responding officers knew that it was the unmistakable smell of decomposition.
I've investigated incidences where there's been dead bodies in residences, and that foul smell is consistent with a dead body.
The officers called out to Anthony, and he proceeded to walk down the stairs. They noticed that he was shaking and he was struggling to stand. He was holding tightly to the railings and he needed some assistance getting down the stairs.
What's your wife's name?
Megan.
Has anyone heard her call?
Yeah.
Megan?
Maggie.
All right, come on down, buddy.
Have a seat.
You good?
I got you.
So have a seat.
Megan!
It's forward for me, all right? Put your hands forward.
Megan?
They asked him where his family was. He replied that Megan was upstairs and was most likely sleeping. The deputies called out to Megan, and they received no reply. The situation was more than suspicious. Anthony sat down on the stairs and his two deputies tried to get some information out of him. Three other deputies proceeded through the home. Deputy Christopher Booz noticed that upstairs there was a bedroom to the right and the door was laying open. Through the door, he could see that there were two people laying on mattresses that were on the floor. He called out to Megan and once again he received no reply. He then entered the bedroom and was met by a scene that he will never forget. He pulled back the blanket on one of the beds and saw the decomposing body of Megan. He then pulled back another blanket, which revealed the decomposing bodies of Alec and Tyler.
The bodies were discolored black and blue. They were sitting, there were two boys sitting on top of a I believe a mattress on the floor. It almost looked like their feet or some of their flesh may have been falling off of the body or decomposing at that point.
Breezy's body was found nearby. At first, the deputies couldn't see Zoe.
When we went into the bedroom, what looked like the two boys on the floor were very obviously seen right when you walked in, as well as what appeared to be Megan in the bed. But we could not identify where his daughter was. And we had known that there were three children that we were that were expected to be at the residence. So we asked where the location of his daughter was.
The deputies called out to Anthony on the stairs. He slurred that he hadn't seen her and suggested that maybe she was sleeping somewhere.
Want me to get a chair for you to sit down in? What's that?
Hey, can you go out there and grab some gloves?
We still can't find a daughter.
What?
Where's Zoe?
I haven't seen her. She went with you. I didn't see her. I was sleeping. She was in here. I haven't seen anything.
Upon looking closer in the bedroom, however, the deputies found Zoe's decomposing body wrapped in a blanket at the foot of the bed. The stench of decomposition was overwhelming. It was evident that the family had been dead for weeks. Their clothing was stained with fluids that released during decomposition. A special agent, Michael Phelps, said, "The bodies were discolored black and blue. Megan had sustained two stab wounds to the upper abdomen. They were both 8 inches deep. Alec had sustained a stab wound to the left upper abdomen. The wound was 4.5 inches deep. Tyler had also sustained a stab wound to the upper left abdomen. It had penetrated his intestines and was around 3.5 inches deep. There were no visible wounds to Zoe or Breezy. Autopsies would confirm that all of the victims had been drugged with Benadryl. There was blood in Megan's abdomen, meaning that she had been stabbed either before or during her death. The single stab wounds to Alec and Tyler, however, did not leave any blood in their abdomens, indicating that they were already dead when they were stabbed. In each victim's hand, deputies found a rosary. Two bloody buck knives were recovered from the home as well as several packages of Benadryl, which had Anthony's fingerprints on them. Anthony was arrested at the home on a warrant for multiple counts of homicide and one count of animal cruelty. From jail, he was transported straight to hospital after informing deputies that he had ingested Benadryl as well, hence the strange demeanour at the home, and he had made comments about wanting to kill himself. Before his arrest, he had taken a fair amount of Benadryl, but it wasn't enough to kill him or enough to do any real harm. The following day, Osceola County Sheriff Ross Gibson held a press conference and revealed that Anthony had made a confession to the mass murder of his family.
Anthony has cooperated with the investigation and he has confessed to killing his wife, Megan Tote, 42 years of age, whose date of birth is January 28, 1977, and their three children. Alec Tote, 13 years of age, born September 26, 2006. Tyler Tote, 11 years of age, born December 30th, 2008. And Zoe Tote, who was 4 years of age, born July 23rd, 2015. Anthony also killed their family dog, Breezy.
The murder stunned not only the community of Celebration, but further afield in Colchester as well. Dimitri Kostavas, who owned a pizza restaurant in Colchester and who worked next door to Anthony for a while, said, "We're family friends and they were always good people. We met when we were coaching our kids at soccer 10 years ago. All the people that knew them had nothing but good things to say." Colchester officials posted on the Colchester website, "It is in times like these that our town pulls together and shows what we are made of, compassion and kindness." The community completely struggled to make sense of the tragedy. By all appearances, Anthony looked to be a loving and caring father, working as hard as possible to carve out a nice life for his family. And now, he was accused of killing them all. A quick look on his Facebook page, one would believe that he was a true family man. On one photograph he posted of the family, he had written, "I am truly blessed beyond words." You can see some photographs of the family on the Vodacast app. An investigation was immediately launched, and investigators were in particular wanting to look into the family's background and financial history. Anthony and Megan were high school sweethearts. They had both earned a master's degree in physical therapy while back in Connecticut. In 2006, they purchased a home together, and then they opened up their own practice, Family Physical Therapy in Colchester, where Anthony was listed as the owner and Megan was listed as a physical therapist. They had another practice in Westchester. In July of 2005, the couple purchased a two-bedroom condo on Longview Avenue in Celebration, Florida. At the time, they sometimes travelled for their business, so this was somewhere that they would stay while travelling around. They also wanted the condo to be an investment. Then in 2017, they sold their home in Colchester for $348,000. 2 years later, the family moved into the rented home, a reserve place in Celebration. The home was absolutely gorgeous and was the kind of home that many can only imagine living in. It was a four-bedroom, four-bathroom, New England-style home with a swimming pool out the back, perfect for the children. The home that they were renting on Reserve Place had sold the year beforehand for $650,000. Over in Florida, Anthony travelled between work in Colchester and home in Celebration, while Megan was a stay-at-home mother. She homeschooled the couple's three children and she loved making meals from scratch. Those who knew Megan said that her entire being was encompassed in her motherhood. Alec and Tyler had been taking piano lessons with Bobby Sedwick, who was a private music teacher in Celebration. Bobby and Megan had bonded over their homeschooling methods and became really close friends. Bobby commented, "She was a dear friend. She was a mom who took care of her family." The children were all very musically gifted. In addition to the piano, Alec played violin and Tyler played guitar. Alec was said to be an exceptionally bright boy who, in addition to music, really enjoyed reading. He was the serious older brother, but he always made time to conspire with his little brother, Tyler. Tyler was the joker of the family, also known as the comic relief. He was always quick to come out with a witty joke, but he was also super compassionate. He was definitely the mischievous one of the family. As for Zoe, she was known as Princess Zoe. She always held out her own with her two big brothers, and she wasn't afraid to reprimand them if she ever felt they needed it. Zoe was really looking forward to starting ballet lessons in the near future, and she was said to be quiet but curious. The family was truly complete when they adopted Breezy in 2014. She was just a typical dog, a massive heart filled with unconditional love for her family. She went everywhere with the family and was in the majority of the family photos. Breezy was much more than just a family dog. She was part of the family. The family's neighbours, Michelle and Monica Austin, said that the family just seemed like a regular happy family. The children could often be heard playing in the backyard, and they considered the family to be a well-respected family, working their hardest to provide their children with such a wonderful life. This was something that Anthony himself hadn't had. Anthony had been exposed to violence while just a young boy. At 4 years old, he woke up to the sound of his mother screaming. He walked into the hallway, and he saw a man on top of his mother in bed. He told police that another man picked him up and brought him back to bed. As it transpired, his mother Loretta had been shot in the face while sleeping. The bullet destroyed her left eye and remained lodged in her skull, but she survived. Anthony's father, Robert, had attempted to kill Loretta in a murder-for-hire plot. He was sentenced to two consecutive terms of 5 to 10 years in prison, and he was released after serving 10 years. It seemed extremely poignant that Anthony had witnessed this and was now standing accused of killing his own wife, children and dog. You can learn more about this case on the Vodacast app. Megan herself was estranged from her mother, but she was extremely close with her aunt, Cindy Kopko, and her uncle, Stuart Peel. They had visited the family home in Celebration loads of times, and they loved taking Alec, Tyler and Zoe to the theme parks and beaches. Since the family business was in Colchester, Anthony would work at the practice during the week and then he would commute almost every weekend to Florida. He told friends and family that this was only going to be until the business could sustain itself. The goal was for them all to live in Celebration together. At their practices in Connecticut, There had been a sign on the door saying that they were closed for the holidays and were going to reopen after the 1st of January, but they never reopened. After Christmas, Anthony never returned to Connecticut. To outsiders, it looked as though the Tote family were quintessential of an all-American family, having landed on their feet in such a picturesque area. Their lives certainly did appear to be enviable, but appearances can be very deceiving. What people didn't know was that Anthony had gotten the family into a serious amount of debt. It was uncovered that the Totes were in the process of being sued for failure to pay rent at their home in Reserve Place Celebration. On the 22nd of December 2019, a tenant eviction notice was filed by P&Y Doorday LLC against Anthony and Megan for alleged breach of a lease agreement. In May of that year, they had signed a one-year lease on the home, but by December, they owed almost $5,000 in rent, which was what had prompted the eviction proceeding. Back in the June before this, the Celebration Residential Owners Association filed a suit to foreclose a lien for assessments against Anthony and the Georgetown at Celebration Condominium Association. This was in relation to the condo that they owned in Celebration, as opposed to the home they were renting. The court was asked to allow the sale of the condo to satisfy the Homeowners Association lien. Anthony owed around $3,000 in assessments, interest, late fees, collection costs, and attorney fees. It was also uncovered that Anthony's two companies, Performance Edge Sport LLC and Family Physical Therapy, which were essentially the same thing, owed almost $100,000 to two creditors for unpaid loans. On the 1st of March 2019, Business Merchant Funding filed a civil lawsuit seeking over $28,000. Interest and attorney fees brought that up to $36,000. On the 24th of January 2019, Green Capital Funding LLC sought over $50,000, and due to interest and attorney fees, that was now up to $63,000. Family Physical Therapy had two offices, and in November, the one in Park Avenue had closed suddenly. Patients weren't informed that they were closing, and they were in the middle of treatment and needed to find a new therapist with absolutely no notice. According to records, Anthony's physical therapy license had expired on the 30th of September, and he didn't bother to renew it. In Westchester, the landlords for the Family Physical Therapy's office had also begun the process of evicting them from their office. Anthony had not paid the rent for December or January, and he had owed them almost $6,300. In addition, the people who were employed at the physical therapy practices hadn't been paid by Anthony, and Anthony was actually under investigation by the Connecticut Office of the Attorney General. In November, the FBI had actually shown up at Family Physical Therapy. It was discovered that the Inspector General's office in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services was investigating Anthony's business practices, and so were the FBI. In an affidavit, Special Agent Jeffrey Anderson said that they had been investigating Anthony since April of 2019. It read in part that they were investigating allegations that Tote and Family Physical Therapy are engaged in a healthcare fraud scheme involving the submission of fraudulent claims for physical therapy sessions to the Connecticut Medicaid program and to private health insurance plans, including Anthem Blue Cross Shield, for physical therapy services that were not in fact rendered to patients. As it turned out, Anthony had billed Medicaid for tens of thousands of dollars worth of appointments that never actually took place, and these involved a number of patients. There were five parents whose children were receiving physical therapy from Anthony, and these parents were covered by Medicaid, which is private insurance or both. These children were going in for treatments twice a week, but the coverage was billed as much as five times a week. In fact, Anthony was even accused of billing for treatments even after families moved away from the state. In one instance, he had claimed he was treating a young basketball player for a torn muscle. But this was long after the basketball player had been cleared to play and stopped going to physical therapy. In total, Anthony billed Medicaid more than $24,000 in treatments that were never performed. Anthony even sent out numerous bills for services that he allegedly performed on Saturdays, despite the fact he was closed on Saturdays. It wasn't just Medicaid that Anthony was defrauding either. He had also been defrauding Anthem, Cigna, and other healthcare benefit programs. In total, he had raked in more than $130,000 in fraudulent bills, and it was only discovered when a patient transferred to another practice and found that her children's records had been falsified. The new physical therapist that had been treating the woman's family found that the treatments had not actually been performed, but they had been billed. With the money that Anthony received for treatments that weren't performed, he then made payments on more than 20 short-term, high-interest loans that he had taken from a plethora of lenders, as mentioned. Anthony knew that he was being investigated, and in fact, he admitted to the fraud. He confessed to the FBI that he was billing for non-existent services to keep pace with the personal loans that he was taking out. When the FBI asked Anthony whether Megan knew about the fraudulent billing practices, he responded, "No, only me." He had agreed to retain an attorney before meeting with authorities and said he would return to Connecticut from Florida on the 8th of December, but Anthony never came back to Connecticut. In fact, when deputies responded to the Tote home on the 9th of January, it was actually in relation to this investigation. They were there to serve an arrest warrant for Anthony from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. When he hadn't returned to Connecticut, they'd gotten in contact with Anthony's loved ones and were informed that they couldn't find Anthony or the rest of the family. Anthony's family had all been made aware about the mounting debt, and when they were searching for the family, they did mention it to police in Florida. Anthony's sister on a phone call to police had said, "There's an active FBI investigation up here in Connecticut, and I'm concerned because of that. Because of a lot of stuff that's been happening, that there could be something happening. I hope to God I'm wrong." It was a chilling prelude to what police would ultimately find in the family's home. So in short, Anthony had been living well beyond his means for quite some time, and he must have been feeling the heat from all these people who were chasing him for money. Then on top of that, he was being investigated by the FBI for fraud, and if found guilty, he would be looking at a prison sentence and even more debt. After Anthony was arrested and was informed that his family were deceased, he said that he wanted to be with them.
"I feel very sad and very upset that I'm still here. And is there somewhere else you'd rather be with my family? On the other side? Okay. And you do know your wife and children are deceased?"
"Yes, and that's where I want to be."
"That's where you want to be? Okay."
Anthony readily confessed to the murders, but he claimed that it had been part of an elaborate murder-suicide arranged between himself and Megan. He explained that Megan, who was chronically ill, had started watching videos that predicted an upcoming apocalypse and described how to reach salvation.
"And in watching these videos and watching everything going on, she presented them to me, and I started watching them with kind of a And the more and more I watched, the more and more I gained an understanding that there is more than this life here. Mm-hmm. A higher global consciousness." Mm-hmm. "And then we started researching, and then we started finding more about the world just coming to the end, the apocalyptic end, and that families are going to be separated and enslaved. And to better to avoid this, to all go together." "Okay."
"You mean die together?"
"Die together, that's correct."
"Okay."
"Okay. So, because my wife's been chronically ill for a while, this really appealed to her. And because it appealed to me also, because she wouldn't be in any pain, family wouldn't be separated. Mm-hmm. There'd be no more sorrow, no more heartbreaking, no more anything. It'd be a salvation and everlasting life."
According to Anthony, he and Megan had spoken to the children about killing themselves.
"We had sat down and talked with the boys and Zoe just on different things about, you know, death and the way what would happen if mommy died, you know, how would you feel, what happened when daddy died, what would you feel? And because the response was that we don't want you to die, we want to die with you."
"Okay. So when did you guys start talking to the children about this?"
"Luckily,
before January, no?
No, it was before Thanksgiving.
Okay. And your wife first showed you these videos when?
She started watching them, or she first started showing them to me in April.
April. Okay.
He explained that he and Megan started planning the murder-suicide before Christmas, but they wanted to wait until after the Christmas concert because the children were looking forward to it.
We didn't want to live without them either. We wanted to bring the whole family together and make it transverse together. Okay. So we were coming up with different things of how we could do this. We didn't know how we could do this because we're not violent people. Okay. Not violent people at all. First we said, what if we, started reading different things? There's something came on TV about cough medicine. Okay? So could they have some cough medicine that I put them to sleep, like overdose of cough medicine, just put them to sleep. And the advice piece will that. Mm-hmm. We're just going to have to do some sort of exsanguination. Okay? Plead to death. Okay? And that's how they used to do it way in the back, when they used to do sacrificial things.
You take a plea to death?
Bleed to death.
Oh, bleed to death, sorry. Okay.
That's okay. Okay. And so we started researching where would be the easiest to stab, to do, why not, so the kids could bleed to death, maybe in combination with the sleep drug.
Okay.
Okay. And that's how everything led up to me.
Okay.
Anthony then began to speak about the murders. He said that Zoe was asleep in her bedroom. Alec was asleep in the boys' bedroom, and Tyler was asleep in the library room downstairs.
And it was to Zoe first.
Okay.
Meg walked into the room, and she walked back into her room.
Step by step. So you guys are sleeping in the master room, I'm assuming?
Yes, my wife and I. And the puppy.
And the puppy, okay. Which boy was upstairs?
Zoe was upstairs in her room.
Okay.
Alec was upstairs in his room. Tyler was asleep downstairs in the library room.
And why again was he down there?
The two of them were sick, so we kept them apart.
Okay.
He detailed how Zoe was killed first. He went into her bedroom and sat alongside her for a couple of hours. As he said, he couldn't bring himself to kill her.
And it took me 2 or 3 hours sitting there because it's a tough, but the everlasting salvation, the thought of that everlasting salvation was there, and I needed to save her soul in order to be with us.
Anthony had brought a knife into the bedroom with him and said that the initial plan was for him to stab Zoe in the stomach.
The initial thought was to stab into the umbilicus above the navel, so I could get the inferior vena cava or the abdominal aorta and be bleed out with no time whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I know I tried. I don't know if I ever punctured it. I don't know if I did or not. I saw a little mark on her, but I don't know if I saw anything. But then she rolled and started screaming, and I put my hand over her mouth, and I put a pillow over top of her, so she went, and she started to fade away. And I just held that until there was no motion left.
When Zoe rolled over, Anthony placed a pillow over her head and applied as much pressure as possible. He commented that he rolled on top of his 30-pound daughter to prevent her from struggling.
So how long would you say it took you to take her life?
The whole motion?
Yeah.
Like, from the minute that I was sitting in there, or from...
I would say once you initially take action, so how long from the time that you had the knife out to the suffocation until you think that she was deceased?
Want to say 10 minutes, 15 minutes, around there. It seemed like that light night took forever, so it's hard to really gauge on the time.
Okay. And you said you used a pillow over her head?
Yes.
Was she face up or face down?
She kept moving.
Anthony said that as he killed Zoe, Megan waited outside the bedroom. Alec was next.
Okay, so what happens?
We walk in. He's on his back. She's just sitting there holding his feet together. We're just in there, just eyeing each other. Just gaining the confidence, I guess, you know. And I go to, I stabbed him. And he started kicking. Was trying to get out. And he kept rolling. So I ended up putting a, there was a pillow there, I ended up putting a pillow in the back of his head so he wouldn't hit me with the back of his head. And I reached around with my hand and held his nose in his mouth.
Anthony said that he suffocated Alec and stabbed him once in the chest. While doing so, he alleged that Megan held Alec's legs. Next, Anthony went into the library, where Tyler was asleep on the sofa. Much like Alec, he too was suffocated and stabbed.
It was in the room when he killed. It's just me and Tyler. Megan is outside in the door.
What is she saying during any of this?
She's doing meditations.
Was she drinking or consuming anything that would maybe...
Not at that point,
bring her down?
Anthony claimed that while killing Tyler, Megan was doing meditations. Breezy was next. She was suffocated. As Anthony said, they wanted Breezy to be with the rest of the family in the afterlife. With the children and Breezy dead, Anthony claimed that Megan drank wine and then stabbed herself in the stomach. He said that they lay down and waited for death together, but death didn't come. He said that Megan then requested some Benadryl, hoping that it would speed up the process.
She had a glass of wine with the stuff. Okay. We were laying there for about 45 minutes. After she stabbed herself, she says, I feel nothing happening. Nothing happening. I said, okay. This is good. What do you want to do? Like, you know. She said, do we have any Benadryl? I said, we have a liquid Benadryl. She goes, let me have that. Let me try some of that. Maybe that will put me to sleep or let me go sooner. So she was drinking a little bit of Benadryl. And I was checking back on her, give her some peace. Walked around, came back, And at one point I thought she had passed from doing the Benadryl. Nope, she was still there. And she had sat up.
What makes you think she passed?
She was very quiet. There was no motion. I couldn't see her abdomen going up and down.
He said that he left her for a while. And when he came back, he believed that she was dead. But then he realized that she wasn't.
She was, I want you to take the pillowcase, put it over my head. I said, I don't know if I can do that. And she looked at me, she goes, if you love me, you can do this. I want to be with my babies.
According to Anthony, Megan asked him to finish her off by suffocating her with a pillow, to which he complied. After Anthony killed his family, he then lived in the house with their bodies, as they gradually decomposed, for 2 weeks. He explained that in those 2 weeks he had attempted to take his own life in a variety of ways, including overdosing on Benadryl and hanging himself. He said that he chickened out of using a knife. During the confession, Anthony said that he took full responsibility for the murders and commented, if I could commit suicide right now, I would. I'm not hiding behind lawyers. You can see the confession in full on the Vodacast app. On the 15th of January, Anthony appeared in court for the first time, where he was denied bail and was granted a public defender. The following week, the community of Celebration came together to hold a vigil for Megan, Alec, Tyler, Zoe, and Breezy. Around 200 people came to Lakeside Park to share their fondest memories of the family. A lot of parents had brought their children along in the hopes that it could help them begin their grieving process. While Alec and Tyler were homeschooled, they still made a lot of friends in the neighbourhood. For them to be faced with such a heinous murder at such a young age had led to so many questions, even more so since it was the children's father who had taken their lives. A group of pastors led prayers for the family, and a number of deputies who had responded to the crime scene were in attendance. They lit candles in silence while a bagpipe poignantly played a rendition of Amazing Grace. There were a handful of photographs of the family during happier times, such as a photograph of Megan and all her children. Anthony was not in any of the pictures. Ryan Green, who lived nearby, recollected to the crowd how Alec and Tyler were amazing soccer players and always the first to get down and dirty in the mud. He said that Alec never minded putting himself forward to play the goalie because none of the other kids really liked it. As Ryan said, he was a go-with-the-flow team player. Ryan stated before the crowd, they were like our own kids. They were good people. I don't know why it happened. Over in Colchester, the community would follow suit, holding their own candlelight vigil for the family in the town green. It had been organised by former workers at Family Physical Therapy, who wanted to reconcile their shock with their grief. Megan's uncle, Stuart, was holding a sign which read, "Remember them with love." His sister, Elizabeth Campbell, said that they had gathered not to remember how they had died, but instead to remember how they had lived. Alex Talland, as a piano player, was truly on display when an audio recording of him playing Amazing Grace was played aloud for the crowd to hear. His friend, Avery Robel, who had been scheduled to sing alongside him in May, sang along. As she said, "But since they passed on, I don't have an opportunity to sing anymore, so this is going to be my opportunity to accompany Alec." At the end of what can often feel like an endless work day, the last thing I want to do is make dinner. From filing Freedom of Information requests to writing and recording episodes, the days can be long. The urge to just order a takeaway can be strong, but thanks to Daily Harvest, I don't have that takeaway temptation anymore. Daily Harvest keeps my freezer fully stocked with options that are delivered right to my front door. They're delicious, and they're ready in just minutes. Daily Harvest delivered the most amazing harvest bowls, soups, flatbreads, snacks, smoothies, lattes, and more. They're all built on organic fruit and vegetables, and there's something for every meal of the day, from their spiced pear and cranberry smoothie to their cauliflower rice and kimchi harvest bowl, which are my personal favourites. With Daily Harvest, you never have to worry if what you're eating is good for you, because their foods are created with health in mind, both my health and the planet's health. Just recently, they've added Harvest Bakes to their collection, and they taste delicious. Avoid the takeout temptation and get Daily Harvest. Go to dailyharvest.com/morbidology to get up to $40 off your first box. That's dailyharvest.com/morbidology for up to $40 off your first box. dailyharvest.com/morbidology. A GoFundMe had also been established in the aftermath of the murders. The community had really wanted to do something to help the extended family. The purpose of the GoFundMe was to help pay for the family's funerals. It read in part, "Please donate as little or as much as you are willing. We cannot take the pain and heartbreak away from any of their family and friends. We can, however, take away some of the costly burden of the final arrangements that include their transportation, funeral, burial site and markers." People came to the GoFundMe in droves, and it ultimately gathered more than $22,000. A wake and mass was scheduled for the end of January for Megan, Alec, Tyler, Zoe and Breezy at St. John the Anvilist Church. A massive Christian burial was to take place, followed by a reception. There was then going to be a private burial at a later date. A massive celebration burial in the Catholic faith suggests burial of the dead will occur right after or in the days and weeks following the mass. The bodies unfortunately still remained in Florida, while further toxicology reports were taking place. The family asked that in lieu of flowers, grievers could make memorial donations to ATZ Scholarship Fund through the Bank of America. Around 200 people gathered for the service, and there was barely a dry eye in the church. At the front was a flower arrangement and framed photographs of the family. There were no photographs of Anthony. Reverend Robert Borghino said during the service, "Now is the time to share especially good memories of especially good lives." Mike Kaplan delivered a eulogy from the family. He said, "It's okay to be upset. It's okay to cry. It's okay to be mad, but don't stay there. It's hard to put into words the impact that Megan, Alec, Tyler and Zoe had on our lives. It was hard to meet them and not love them." He implored those in attendance to remember the fun times, the laughter, the jokes, the cookies, the sunsets and teaching Breezy new tricks, before ending his eulogy with, "Remember them for who they were and what they brought to our lives." Before January came to a close, Anthony was formally charged with 4 counts of second-degree murder. This meant that Anthony was not eligible for the death penalty, but that could change if those charges were elevated to first-degree murder. Florida law requires a grand jury indictment for capital crimes, and the second-degree charges were filed to keep Anthony in custody until a grand jury could be convened. Anthony would enter a written plea of not guilty to the charges, but shortly thereafter, it was announced by State Attorney Aramis Ayala that she would be seeking the death penalty against Anthony. Back in 2017, she had announced that she would not be seeking the death penalty in Orange and Osceola County cases, but her death penalty review panel had unanimously decided that they would indeed be seeking the death penalty against Anthony. It wasn't much of a surprise. The case was absolutely heinous, and it sent shockwaves not only across the nation, but across the world. A grand jury had decided that Anthony's charges of second-degree murder would be elevated to first-degree murder. This meant that Anthony was now facing 4 counts of capital murder and 1 count of animal cruelty. Prosecutors would file a notice regarding their decision in which they said they believed that they could prove the aggravating factors necessary to justify the death penalty, including that the murders were committed in a cold, calculated, and premeditated manner, and that the victims were vulnerable because Anthony stood in a position of familiar or custodial authority over them. Anthony's father, Robert, who had been convicted 40 years earlier of the attempted murder of his mother, said that the decision did not surprise him. He stated, "No one wants to hear that their son will be put to death for some reason, no matter what the reason is. But looking at it from the outside, looking in, it wasn't something that was unexpected." He said he hoped that the prosecution would take into consideration his son's mental state at the time of the murders, adding he believed that something wasn't right with Anthony. Around the same time, a jail phone call between Anthony and his sister, Chrissy, was released.
"I don't remember anything pretty much over Christmas and the first week I got here. I don't remember coming here."
In the phone call, Anthony said that on the day of the murders, he had gone to the family's condo to pick up Zoe's Mickey Mouse necklace. He then made a very cryptic statement.
"The night everything happened, okay, I'm going to tell you this. I went over because Zoe wanted her Mickey silver necklace for reasons you'll find out later."
The cryptic statement was in relation to the confession that Anthony had made regarding the alleged murder-suicide and alleged fear of the apocalypse. At the time, Anthony's confession had not yet been made public. He told Chrissy that he loved Megan and the children to the end, stating, "Just so you know, I couldn't take the love out of loving her. I wanted you to know." Anthony then inquired about how their mother was.
"Is Mom okay?
Okay. You don't have to answer."
"Hold on. Give me a sec to think about it. She's okay. I mean, obviously, she's very upset. She's reliving a lot."
"Tell her I love her, please."
"I will."
Shortly after this phone call, Anthony then sent a letter to his father from behind bars. Anthony claimed that it was Megan who had killed the children, not him. He claimed that she had given them a pie laced with Benadryl and then stabbed and suffocated them. He claimed that he had returned home and found his children dead. He said that Megan was still alive and confessed to killing the children. In the letter, he wrote, "At the news of this, I ran to the bathroom and puked. I was weak. She continued to tell me what happened, and then she wanted to pray and meditate together." He wrote that Megan then drank a bottle of Benadryl and stabbed herself in the stomach. He wrote, "I love my wife, still, very deeply, and it will be the hardest thing to sit there and tell everyone that it was her that did this when I was not at home, and then she died by suicide in front of me." Anthony and his father had been estranged, but following Anthony's arrest, they began to speak quite regularly. As his father Robert said, he was working on building a relationship with his son. In fact, he had only met Alec and Tyler once, and he had never met Zoe. Then in a later phone call that Anthony had with his sister, he was told that the family would have done anything to help the family out. Anthony replied, "I wasn't allowed. I'm sorry I was forced to move away from you guys. That was all her. She had it really limited and didn't want anyone to know anything about what was going on." As can be quite common in familial side cases, Anthony was blaming Megan for the murders. By January of the following year, prosecutors announced that they were no longer seeking the death penalty against Anthony. In filing that was submitted, State Attorney Ayala wrote, "After consideration of the facts and law applicable to this case, including serious concerns regarding the mental health of the defendant, it is not in the best interest of the people of the state of Florida to pursue the death penalty as a potential sentence." Around the same time, federal prosecutors in Connecticut filed a motion to temporarily dismiss the healthcare fraud case against Anthony. The purpose was so that the murder case in Florida could proceed expeditiously and without undue concern or complications related to the federal complaint. The murder trial was scheduled for September of 2021, but before then there were a number of pre-trial hearings. Anthony's defense team attempted to get photographs depicting the family's dead bodies excluded from evidence during the trial. They also tried to get Anthony's confession thrown out and information regarding the healthcare fraud. Anthony's defense attorney, Peter Schmer, described in court how Megan, Alec, Tyler, and Zoe had been dead for at least 2 weeks when they were found, and they were significantly decomposed. He referred to the photographs of the bodies as shocking and extremely prejudicial. Graphic photographs can be entered into evidence during a murder trial, but they're only admissible if they are relevant and not so shocking in nature as to defeat the value of their relevance. The issues raised would result in the trial being pushed back. The judge would ultimately decide that certain crime scene photographs from the case could be entered into evidence. I'm going to be uploading a handful of these onto my Patreon, but none of them are going to be remotely graphic, just more so photographs depicting the home and Anthony's mugshots. The judge also ruled that the healthcare fraud information could not be mentioned, but prosecutors said that they never planned to link the two cases. It would also be decided that some of the confession could be presented to the jury. Early the next year, the judge ruled that Anthony's defense team could not present evidence relating to the mental health issues that he exhibited after his arrest. Anthony had expressed suicidal thoughts and had been involuntarily committed under Florida's Baker Act, but this couldn't be disclosed to the jury during the upcoming trial. This was decided because Anthony's defense team were not pursuing an insanity claim, and the diminished capacity defense is not allowed in the state of Florida. More than 2 years after the murders had taken place, the trial finally opened. On the 11th of April 2022, the jury were seated and the trial was ready to begin. During opening statements, State Prosecutor Danielle Pinnell informed the jury that after Anthony's arrest, he had made a full confession to the murders. But then the following year, he changed his story and instead tried to claim that it was Megan who had killed the children and then herself. She presented the prosecution's theory that the murders had been committed as a murder-suicide because Anthony believed that the apocalypse was coming. She stated, "Everybody needed to die in order to pass over to the other side, because the apocalypse was coming." She briefly spoke about Anthony's confession.
Alexander Tote was older. He's the oldest child. And he was sleeping upstairs. Tyler Tote, at the time of his death, was downstairs. You're going to hear that the defendant told Detective Miller that he went next to Alexander Tote and he suffocated Alexander Tote, and he also stabbed Alexander Tote in his abdomen. And after the evidence will show that after Alexander Tote was dead, he went downstairs to Tyler Tote, who was sleeping on a sofa bed in the playroom. And you're going to hear that the defendant was more concerned about Tyler Tote because Tyler Tote was the fastest. He was afraid that if something didn't go the way that he wanted, Tyler Tote would escape.
The defense deferred their opening statements and said they would be making a statement after the prosecution rested their case. A forensic expert testified about the Benadryl found inside the home. Aaron West, the crime scene manager, said that fingerprints were found on 10 containers of Benadryl and that 7 of them matched with Anthony's fingerprints. Some other fingerprint results were inconclusive, but she said she could not exclude Anthony. Defense Azalea Carlos Romero Sanchez asked during cross-examination whether Megan's fingerprints had been compared to any of the fingerprints found. She responded, "I did not compare Megan Tote to any of the exhibits." Due to the state of decomposition of the bodies, Jennifer Nara, the medical examiner who had conducted the autopsies, said that she could not determine whether the victims had been strangled or suffocated. She said that the cause of death for all the victims was homicidal violence of unspecified means, in association with a Benadryl toxicity. She said that the amount of Benadryl in the victims could have caused fatigue, lethargy, or possibly a coma. She commented that the boys had been stabbed after they were already dead, unlike Megan, who was stabbed twice while still alive. She said that she could not determine whether the stab wounds to Megan were self-inflicted or inflicted by somebody else. As for the knife that was found in the bedroom with the bodies, crime lab analyst Christopher Conklin said that the handle of the knife contained a mixture of DNA from three people, with the entire family being possible contributors. Graphic photographs of the bodies of Megan, Alec, Tyler and Zoe were displayed for the jury to see. Much to the surprise of many who'd followed the case in the media, Anthony would be called to testify on his own behalf. He shuffled up to the witness stand and once again, like he had done the year beforehand, he attempted to blame Megan for the murders. He explained that Megan suffered from chronic pain related to a litany of medical conditions. Now, this was true, Megan did have a number of health issues. She had been diagnosed with Lyme disease, a heart issue which included a murmur, and hepatitis. He said that Megan's chronic pain was the impetus for her belief that the family needed to die in order to be reincarnated into a better life. Anthony spoke about Megan's ailments, commenting that she couldn't keep weight on and that she couldn't breathe while sick. He said that she suffered a miscarriage which threw her into a deep depression.
She was a yoga teacher in addition to physical therapist. She went from a very strong, vibrant woman to barely holding on to 90 pounds. She couldn't keep weight on. She couldn't breathe. Her heart rate progressively was going crazy. At rest, it would be 190 or above.
Anthony said that Megan then became involved in a religious group that strongly believed in an afterlife component, and that if they burned the family karma in their current life, they could be reincarnated into a better life. Anthony claimed that on the morning of the murders, Megan woke up and claimed that she was pain-free. He said he went to the family's condo that day and stayed overnight sleeping in the family's van. He claimed that when he returned home the next morning, all the children were dead. He said that Megan had killed the children with a poisoned pie, which completely contradicted his initial confessions.
My own demeanor, when I found out what happened, I puked. I cried. I was in total denial of what happened. I couldn't understand. And then after that, I was like, I want to get you help. I'll take responsibility for this. Just get help. That's all I wanted. I would do anything in my life to do what she needed, provide for what she needed, provide her a happy life. I held my wife on a pedestal. I didn't care anything to myself. I wanted her to have a good life, period. And I wanted her to get help.
According to Anthony, when he was back home, Megan stabbed herself. In the days that followed, he claimed that he attempted to complete suicide at least 10 times.
Did you have ideas of joining your family in the afterlife?
After I saw everybody die? After I saw my wife die and saw my kids? Most definitely. I wanted to be with them. That's the only thing I wanted to be. I didn't care by what means. I didn't care by what anything. I sliced my wrist. I took multiple doses of Benadryl. I tried to hang myself several times. I bought a pellet gun to shoot myself because I couldn't get a gun to, as you call it, eat a gun.
On the witness stand, Anthony claimed that he had no recollection of confessing to the murders, but said he remembered telling Megan that he would take the blame. He said, "I was covering for my wife, obviously unsuccessfully. I had no clue how my children died." It was kind of an ironic statement considering the fact that when he confessed, he got every piece of detail correct. Megan, Alec, and Tyler had been suffocated and stabbed, while Zoe had just been suffocated. Furthermore, why would Anthony tell Megan that he was going to take the blame if he planned on taking his own life? After Anthony's testimony, both the prosecution and the defence rested. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Pinnell told the jury that Anthony had nonchalantly detailed the murders before claiming he was covering for his wife. She said that Anthony had wanted to control the lives of his family. She revealed that Anthony had told a detective that they bring their children into the world, so they get to decide when they leave. She also revealed that after killing his family, Anthony had texted friends and family pretending that they were sick. He even sent text messages from Megan's phone talking about the apocalypse. But Megan was already dead by this point. By all appearances, Anthony was already trying to plant the seed of doubt for when his crimes were eventually revealed. The defense, on the other hand, maintained that the prosecution had not proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Anthony was the one to kill his family. Defense Alicia Smith said, "He came home to his kids being dead. His wife was alive, but essentially dying, and stabbed herself in front of him." In a final comment to the jury, Prosecutor Pinnell said that there was absolutely no reasonable doubt in the case. The jury were sent off to deliberate. It really boiled down to whether they believed Anthony's original confession or his second one. After 6 hours of deliberation, the jury found Anthony Tote guilty on all counts. As the verdict was read aloud, Anthony shook his head. He then turned to Judge Keith Carstein, said that he loved his wife, and then in the same breath, tried to claim that she had been verbally abusing the children. Victim impact statements would be presented. Megan's aunt, Cynthia, described her niece and children as loving people. She said that not only had the family suffered, but so had the children in the neighbourhood, who called Alec, Tyler, and Zoe friends.
They were just fun-loving, and all the children, I just have to say something about the communities that were affected. All the children in celebration that they played with. They had a beautiful basketball hoop, which was donated to the children, and they're going to make a little monument thing out of it. The children would ask their fathers, "Are you going to kill me at some time? Do you think you're going to kill me?" Because the children were, Megan's kids were just so fun-loving and giving and loved all their friends that, and they came to the house. They did all kinds of things together. Went in the little playground areas and climbed things and slid and played games. And that's a lot of trauma for a child to ask their father, "Are you going to kill me too?" So they have to deal with those things now, that community.
She revealed that she had warned Megan about Anthony's controlling behavior, revealing that he would constantly call her if she were ever out without him, whether it be shopping or having lunch. Anthony responded to this, claiming that he only did so to make sure that Megan was okay.
"And the reason why I would call so much is because Megan would have bad days, and I just needed to know she was okay. It wasn't a control factor. It wasn't any kind of scoping things out or whatnot. It was my fear that she was, or my fear that something was wrong with her, and I just needed to hear her voice making sure she was okay. I loved my wife. I loved my children. I was not there the night my children died."
Megan's uncle, Stuart, recollected how in the summer the family had rented a lake house in Connecticut. He said, "That was it. That's the last time we saw them." He said that Megan seemed to be happy and healthy, which contrasted Anthony's portrayal of Megan as somebody who was so ill she couldn't walk up the stairs or care for herself. He said that Megan had been sick, but she had improved exponentially. He said, "Every time I saw her, she was fine. There was never any indication that she was frail or weak. This whole story that she was an invalid that he had to take care of wasn't true with me." He said he believed that Anthony had blamed his family for a lifestyle that he could not maintain. It was now up for Judge Carstein to sentence Anthony. But before doing so, Anthony had a couple of statements.
I understand evidence wasn't heard. I don't remember that time, from the time I fell down the stairs to the time I woke up in the jail. I love my kids. I love my kids every day. It's only recently that I just stopped crying myself to sleep. My kids and my wife were everything to me. They were the center of my universe. When I came home, I was shattered. I appreciate you listening to me, sir. And I know you're in your situation. I did not do this.
Judge Carstein then turned to Anthony.
After listening to the evidence presented that you, Anthony John Tote, are a destroyer of worlds, that you destroyed the world of your four-year-old daughter, Zoe Elizabeth Tote, that you destroyed the world of your 10-year-old son, Tyler John Tote, that you destroyed the world of your 13-year-old son, Alexander John Tote, that you destroyed the world of your wife, Megan Denise Tote. The jury has unanimously determined that you murdered each of them with premeditation, based on the evidence presented in this room.
He sentenced Anthony to four consecutive sentences of life in prison without the possibility of parole for each member of the family. He also received a one-year sentence in county jail for the death of Breezy. Anthony Tote had seemingly created a lifestyle that many would be envious of. But behind that veneer, his business was failing and he was taking out loans and paying them back with money that had been stolen. Anthony had created this lifestyle that never really existed. And in the end, instead of come clean to his family, he decided that they would pay the ultimate price. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporter, Annalise. The support on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful for all of your support. If you'd like bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, merch, and more, please do click the link to Patreon in the show notes. Also, the countdown to CrimeCon in London in June has officially begun. I'm going to be there on Podcast Row all weekend, so please do come and hang out. I have a 10% discount for my listeners. Just head to crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. Also remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the podcast, Seriously Sinister. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
He frantically looked around the back seat for something to soak up the two beers he had consumed earlier that evening, but found nothing. That is when a second idea formed in David's mind. He quickly and aggressively ripped out the crotch of his underwear and shoved the cloth deep into his mouth. As he began to chew, he felt a huge sense of defeat. There was no way he would be able to stomach that butt cloth he had partied in all.
Didn't that story just shake you to the core?
Would you like to hear more?
Then you've come to the right place. I'm Trevin.
And I'm Amanda.
And we're the hosts of Seriously Sinister, a true petty crime podcast.
Each week, we take a dramatic dive into real-life petty crimes.
They may make you laugh or cry, but they won't be like any other true crime stories you've heard.
Follow Seriously Sinister wherever you listen to your podcasts.